Okay, we're starting here on the top of Tzadik Zayin Amud Aleph. The Gemara is asking on Rav Shita, which we concluded with yesterday, that it seems that Rav paskins like Rabbi Meir, who according to Rav is really the Chachamim, that the Avadim have a din like Karka. And the Gemara here asks, Umi Amar Rav, Avda Kamimakarke Dami. Does Rav really think that Avadim have the same din as Karka? V'amar Rav Daniel Barav Katina Amar Rav, Hatokef Ba'abdo Shel Chaveiro. Someone who presses into service the Eved Knani of his friend, Basabo Melacha, and he utilizes him, Patur, he doesn't have to pay for it. Now, the assumption being here that once you've stolen the item, it becomes yours. Once it's yours and then you utilize it, you don't have to pay for the utilization of the object because you're going to pay Keshata Gzela. At the point of Gzela, it shifts into your possession. Once it shifts into your possession, whatever you're doing afterwards is utilizing your own Eved because you're going to pay the full value of that Eved back to the person you stole from. On the other hand, if it's deemed kekarka, if it has a din like land, karka enin igzelet, you can't steal land. You can't steal land, as Tosafot points out over here, then it belongs to the Balim, and it's as if you're taking something that belongs to the Balim and utilizing it, you have to pay them the schar, you have to pay them the wages or the value that you are utilizing with this Eved. Over here, if you say you are Patur, it's pretty much indicating that you think this is Metaltalim and not Karka. Because if it was Karka, you'd have to pay for the Sakhar. So as Gemara says, V'isakadatcha avda kemekarke dami, you think that an Eved Knani is a din like Karka, am I Patur? Why is he Patur? B'shuto demarei kai. It's still in the possession of the original owner. Because of the principle of Karka in an exelet, if it's still with the original owner, then you got to pay for the utilization of this object. Where it says, "Halcha ma'iskinan shelo b'shat melacha," was done at a time when the balim were not otherwise utilizing the eved. Kiha d'sholach le Rabbi Ava l'mari bar mar. So this is a sugya that we dealt with together. Boy mi name Rav Huna hadar b'chaser chaveiro shelo midato. Someone who lives in his friend's property without his permission or without his knowledge. Tzarich la'lot lo schar or ain't tzarich la'lot lo schar. Does he have to pay rent, or does he not have to pay rent? You don't have to pay the rent. This is the sugya is otherwise known. We saw this earlier in the Masechta. This person is benefiting. The other party is not losing. Again, back on Chof Aleph, when we discussed the sugya, the Gemara sets this up in a case where the person wouldn't otherwise rent out the property. It's not a property that's omeid l'schirut. So therefore, he's not losing anything by someone being there because he wasn't otherwise going to rent it out anyway. But zenene, the person who lives there, gets the benefit. Zelo chaser, the landlord, is losing nothing because he wouldn't have collected any money anyway. Verse says, hachiyashta. Bishlam ahatam, over there we discussed that there really is a benefit to the owner that is there. Ben laman damar beta mitva yotiv nechale, that when someone is living in a house, rather than a house being empty, they are able to take care of the small problems that come up. They're able to rectify any issues that come up in the house, or they're able to know if there's a little leak here, if there's a problem with this, a problem with that, they're able to fix it. These items, when someone's living there, are taken care of. When the house is abandoned, nobody takes care of these issues. So it's not only zenene v'zelo chaser, it's really zenene v'zenene. They both are getting benefit. Ben lamanda mar ushia yukat shar nechale. Again, here, this says, the literal translation means that desolation or abandonment caused the shar, the gates to fall apart or to deteriorate faster. The Gemara before spoke about the fact that there are shedim that live in areas that are abandoned or that are not lived in. And therefore, when this person lives there, he causes these shedim. Or, if you take it literally, it causes the fact that there is no abandonment there, and therefore, things don't fall apart. So for that reason, the landlord is benefiting from the fact that this individual is living there. Even though we term it as zenene v'zelo chaser, it's really not zenene v'zelo chaser, it's zenene and zelo chaser, but he's really benefiting. Yesh hana'alo. And that's why we say he doesn't have to pay the rent. Elohocha minechele dinichush avde. Over here, there's no benefit to you working with his slave. Okay, you're working with the slave at a time that he wouldn't have utilized it. But still, you're weakening him. You're using up his energy. You're using up his potential. Whatever it is, it's not something that he's necessarily benefiting for. Over here also, it's not zenene v'zeh lo chaser, or even the way the Gemara is phrasing it, zenene v'zeh chaser, but rather, there is a benefit over here, which is that the Eved is not batel, that the Eved is not sitting around without any work. That could be manifested in a number of different ways. Either that we don't want the Eved to become accustomed to being lethargic, sitting around, not doing work. So if you keep him constantly active, it keeps him ready and involved in work. It also a possibility that if this is an Eved who has problems with authority, here exerting authority on him, over a long period of time, meaning that continuously asserting authority over him is beneficial because it doesn't allow him time to consider himself a free person or do his own thing. Or the possibility that this individual, once he rests, once he stops working, that causes him to weaken or lose interest in what he's doing. And so here there is a benefit in keeping him engaged in work on a regular basis. And so there again, it's zenene v'zenene. So for that reason, when he takes it, there's no reason to pay for it. So even though maybe he's deemed to be karka, and you would have to pay for schar, but we've come up with a case here that's really zenene v'zelo chaser, or in other words, zenene v'zenene. And that's why you don't have to pay for him in this case. So now the Gemara tells a story. Bei Rav Yosef Bar Chama, Havutakif Avdei de Inche, de Mesik Behu Zuze, v'Avdei Behu Melacha. They used to confiscate or grab the Eved Knanim of people they had lent money to, and they would utilize them in the meantime. I'm assuming that these people were defaulting on their loans or that there was a problem with collections. So they used to grab their avadim and do work with them. Amalei Rabba Berei. Amalei Rava Berei. Because Rava is the son of Rav Yosef Bar Chama. This is the famous Rava that we know of in Shas. My time Ovid Mar Hachi. He's challenging his father and saying, why are you doing this? Amalei, the Amar Rav Nachman. Avda Nehum Krise Lo Shave. The Eved Knani is not worth the bread he eats. Meaning, he costs more to keep around than he does in benefiting you from the work that he does. He eats more than he produces. He eats more than he is worth. So by confiscating the Avadim, we're actually helping the owners because we're defraying the cost from them by utilizing the Eved and feeding the Eved, which is basically taking over the Eved, which is preventing a loss from them. Eimad Amar Rav Nachman Kungon Daru Avdei Demraked Beikove. Wait a minute. When Rav Nachman was speaking about, he's speaking about this Eved whose proper name was Daru. And he was an Eved that used to dance around in the bars. It seems like this was something that we actually saw before, but the person who had the injury to the head and lost value because of that, because he used to go dance in the bars and people would pay him money for that, and he used to tip off his hat or take off his hat, and he can't do that anymore. It seems to be this is a similar type of job that this individual engaged in, which was he was either comic relief, or he used to dance to get his food and to get his alcohol. But basically, he wasn't doing any work for anybody. He was simply a comic, a clown. He wasn't worth the food that he was eating. That's when we're describing it. Kuli avdei, ma'avid avdei. A regular Eved Kenani, or most Avdei Kenanim, work in excess of their cost of living. And therefore, they are worthwhile. You can't say this as a generic statement about Avadim. He was speaking about a particular type of Eved who wasn't worth the food that he was eating. So Amalei, Ana K'Rav Daniel Svirle. I hold like Rav Daniel, which is why it's brought over here. Tamar Rav Daniel, Barav, Katin, Amarav, Tukef, Abdosho, Chavirov, Asabo, Malacha, Patur. That's the suya that we brought here. If you take your friend's Eved, then you do work with him. You don't have to pay for it. Alma Nechale Deloli Stari Avde. Based on what we said here, you see that the landlord or the owner of the Eved Kenani is happy or benefits from the fact that you have taken the Eved because then he doesn't lie around. He doesn't get lazy. So he does benefit from it. Amalei Hani Mile Eche Delo Mesik Bil Zuze. That's true when they haven't lent them money. Mar. Came the Masik Beuzuze Mechsek Ribit. You, because you've lent them money, it looks like you're collecting interest on the loan. Because here you are lending them money, you are not defeasing the loan when you work the Eved Kenani. It's not like he's reducing the principal amount, he's simply taking him. Now true, in a vacuum, absent the loan here, you wouldn't have to pay for it. You'd be patur from paying. But in the context of having lent money, This looks really bad. It looks like you are grabbing the eved to use without the knowledge of the owner, and you're doing it because, in essence, you're charging an imputed interest on the loan by having the eved work for you. He says it doesn't look right. Damar Rav Yosef bar Nume, Amar Rav Nachman, Afu Pish Amru Adar B'Chatzir Chaviro Shlomi Dato Ein Tzarich La'alot Lo Skar. So even though we have the principle that Zenene V'Zelo Chaser, you do not have to pay. And you do not have to pay for the rent when you live in that place that the person otherwise would not have lent out. Well, then if you lent him money and then you go, absent his acquiescence, and go live in that place, you do have to pay rent because it looks like ribit otherwise. So Amalei Hadribi. So his father said, I back off. Here the son, Rava, challenges his father, and his father acknowledges that he thinks his son is right. And he stops this practice of pressing into service other people's avadim when he had lent them money. So now, Balei HaTosafot deal here with a very difficult situation, which is that anytime you lend someone money, it seems that you can no longer do or have the normal interactions with that person or the normal favors that you would do for them. You no longer can do it because it looks like ribit. That's what the Gemara suggests over here. In normal circumstances, you'd be permitted to do. You grab your friend's eved, press him into service. Again, when he's not otherwise doing work, and it benefits the owner. You live in the house of this individual, wouldn't have rented it out otherwise. And either you're offsetting the depreciation by the benefits that you bring, or even you're bringing benefits by living there and taking care of the things that break down. So all of those cases, we said, you don't pay anything. Yet if you lend money, in that context, we say you can no longer do that. So now you've almost, in a sense, created a relationship which severs the previous relationship. If they were friends before, if they had a relationship before and they interacted in a certain manner, now that they lent money, all of a sudden you're out the ability to act normally with this individual. Can you go over to the debtor's house for a meal, or does that look like ribit already? Tosafot gives some broad lines about how to do this or how to define this, because he's also troubled by this, because it means a severing of the previous relationship where you have people who are friends and now they can't have their friendship coexist with the loan that has been extended to them. So he says, V'yishlamar, so Tosafot gives a couple of guidelines. The first is, Dafka milei d'befehesya v'avsha tuva. Things that are public, and avsha usually means loud, but things that are easily seen or recognizable. To live in someone else's property, or to take his eved. These are things that are really public displays of utilization. But to lend him like a utensil, he comes over and borrows a spoon, he borrows an egg, or he wants to ride your horse, borrow your car. Things that you would have done otherwise before the loan was extended, those you can continue to do because they are not public, obvious items. So Tosafot, first of all, says that there's a big difference between things that are public displays of taking someone else's property that you can no longer do once you've extended a loan. That's number one. Number two is, Be'od Shema Yishlamar, Kohecha Dekodim Halva Hayu Ohavim Zedzeh, prior to the extension of the loan, if they were good friends, best friends, Shehu Mashlim Chatzer Mizeh Lezeh, and they used to borrow each other's courtyards, then you could do the same thing afterwards. If you don't change the behavior that existed prior to the loan, then that's not considered to be ribit. It's only if the person goes out of his way to be kinder, nicer, say thank you when he wouldn't have otherwise done it beforehand, that might be called ribit. But if they conduct themselves the same way they conducted themselves before, that shouldn't be called ribit because they haven't changed anything. The context of the loan should not change that which it was previously. The only time it becomes deemed like ribit or looks like ribit is if there's a behavioral change because of the loan. So that's the second guideline that Tosafot lays out. And then Tosafot says over here, "Umiu afilu davar she'em ashilo belov achik kagon chaser delo kaimel agra im nichnas shelo midat chaviro chayav." So here is the last qualification he gives, which is there's a big difference between a relationship that existed before, where, for instance, had you had a bar mitzvah, had you had some sort of simcha, and you needed housing, the person would have lent you their house, or they would have given you permission to utilize it. But over here, that's not what you're doing. You're entering it without permission, of the owner. In that case, chayav. Afu pi shim lo ha'uval lo lo ya chayav. Even though had he not lent him the money, he would not be chayav. Letet lo schar k'damash ma'ocha. Nevertheless, when you do it without his permission, that is different than an existing relationship. So those are the three guidelines that Tosafot gives over here for, quote-unquote, overcoming the problem of rebate and maintaining the existing relationship. So here you have these three guidelines, one of which is public, obvious utilization. Maybe that should be problematic and not things where your normal interactions between the individuals. Number two is if it's a consistent behavior that was practiced before the loan was extended and continues afterwards, that maybe should not be deemed to be rebate. And the third thing is, if it's done with permission, if it's done without permission, that could be much more problematic, even though there was a relationship that existed before, doing it without permission, even though if you did it without the context of loan, you would not be chayav, in the context of the loan, that looks much more like rebate. So Tosafot gives those three qualifications or guidelines. He does, in the end, say that it's not so simple what he's saying, and that's not so straightforward, but he's trying to make it so that there's a certain amount of normalcy in the extension of credit that doesn't sever that relationship or the friendship that pre-existed the loan that is extended. Okay, now the Gemara continues. Itmar hatokef sfinato shel chavero. Person commandeers his friend's boat, vasabo melacha, and he utilizes it for his own benefit. Amarav, ratza schara notel, ratza pachta notel. He has a choice here. He can collect the schar being the rental income that was foregone here. He used the boat. He got benefit for it. Had he not taken the boat without permission, he would have to rent it from someone else. So there's foregone rental income. That's number one. Number two is pachta here. It's not clear from the Gemara what the pachta is. Rashi claims is that there was damage to the boat. So then the question is how significant the damage is. Because the more significant the damage, then the more likely that the gazlan here or the commandeering individual over here actually owns the boat then. If he does enough damage and he has to replace the whole boat, he can't just give back the boat plus the diminution or depreciation in value that was here. So it's not clear what the pachta is. Rashi again says damage. Other Rishonim seem to indicate that it might be just depreciation. But whatever it is, he gets to choose, as Rav says over here, whichever is more. Whichever is more money, whether it's the rental income or the damage that was done to the boat, the owner can demand that payment back from the gazlan. Shmuel amar inu tel ela pachta, that he only has the right to take the dmei pachta. It seems here that the pachta exceeds the value of the schar, although then what is Shmuel really being mechadesh? So then you might have to say that Shmuel says only dmei pachta. Samra papa lo plige. There's no machloket here between Rav and Shmuel. Hada avida l'agra, hada lo avida l'agra. Depends on whether the boat is normally rented out or not rented out. And the assumption being here that if it's avida l'agra, if it is a boat that is rented out, then you get to choose the greater of the rent foregone rental income or the damage or depreciation that came about here. If it is d'lo avida l'agra, again, that it's not normally rented out, then you only have one choice over here, which is the choice to take the depreciation or diminution in value, because that's the only thing that you would have collected anyway in these types of circumstances. Both cases here are talking, both Rav and Shmuel are made cases where it normally is a boat that's rented out. The question is, how did the person go down to utilize the boat? Did he go down to utilize the boat for rent? Or he went down to steal it. So it actually turns out here, it's an interesting outcome. If he went down assuming that he was going to pay the rental income, even though he was doing it without permission, he's a shol, shalomidat, he's borrowing without permission, but he intended to pay for it. In that case, the owner gets the choice, basically, to take the foregone rental income, or what the guy would have paid in rental income, or pachta. Whatever value destruction there was here, he can collect that. And maybe even as you're saying, possibly both of them. That he could collect both of them, he can take whatever is the greater of the amounts that need to be paid over here. But that's if he intended to pay. On the other hand, if he goes down as a gazlan, he goes down to steal it, it means that he has no intent of ever paying rent over here. He's literally commandeering the boat and utilizing it. He has no intention to pay rent. Then, as Rashi notes over here, in that case, he only pays the pachta. T'chol ha-gazlanim mishalmim k'shat ha-gzeila. Because a gazlan pays at the time that he steals it, the value of the boat at that time. So what he's going to do now is return the boat, and now he's got to make up the difference between the value of when he took it and the value that it is now. That's a gazlan. And again here, we see this recurring theme that has gone through the parak, which is being a gazlan, in a sense, pays off. That here, being a thief, he'll end up paying less than a person who went down shol shelo midat, goes ahead and utilizes it with the intent to rent it or pay for the rental. In that case, the balim get the higher of the two amounts, whereas over here, if he's a thief, he only gets the lost value or the difference in value from the time that he stole it until the time that he returns it. And this goes back to what we've been saying all along, that if you deem the property stolen at the moment that the gazlan takes it, at the shata gzela, then all the utilization, all the benefit that he gets afterwards is his own. But that means that this gazlan is basically benefiting from the fact that he stole something. He's responsible for its value at the moment that he stole it, but then all of the utilization that he has after that point in time is his. He doesn't have to pay for it. He doesn't have to make any restitution for the fact that he utilized it, he got a benefit, he was the beneficiary of the theft. And so here, again, this continues that same, thematically, that same idea, that the gazlan only pays for the item, and doesn't pay for the benefit that he garners from it. Again, I suggested before that the Gemara believed or thought that the person would replace the item immediately, and therefore there is really no foregone income or losses because he can replace it. But in large items like a boat, that's not so simple. And yet the Gemara here still has this idea that the gazlan only pays kashata gzela. Again, is not in accordance with what we see today in the modern law, where when a person steals something, they pay for the theft, and they pay for any benefit that they gained from that theft. I mean, anything that they accrue or appreciate or income that they gained from the theft, they have to pay that back to the balim, because that's also a loss to the balim. The Gemara now continues from the Mishnah. The Mishnah had cases where it was considered to be a shinoi, and the gazlan was koneit, versus other items that were not a shinoi, where the gazlan is not koneit. The Gemara here is going to speak about coins. By the coin, we gave an example of where it was a shinoi that was koneit, was nizdak. It seems like the coin was cracked or broken. There, it was a shinoi that makes him a kinyan. The other hand, nifsal, if the currency was taken out of circulation for whatever reason, that we said is not a shinoi that allows him to make a kinyan or forces him to have a kinyan on the coin. He can say, he can hand the coin back and say, this is your coin. So now the Gemara is going to try to understand what it means to be nizdak versus nifsal. Okay, Amar Rav Huna, nizdak, nizdak mamash. When the Mishnah says it cracked or it broke or chipped, that means literally that it was a physical break of the coin. Nifsal, psalto malchut. When I say that it's nifsal, it's that the government took it out of circulation. It's no longer allowed to be used in these areas. We're going to see later today that the reasons that they might take it out of circulation is because it's a coin that is minted by some rebellious faction, or it's a coin that's minted by a competing country. So that's why they'll take it out of circulation. The other reasons to take a coin out of circulation is because the content of metal that is in there is so diluted that they no longer consider it to be proper currency in this area. Or the reason might be that there are protectionist reasons why a government would stop coins from other countries being utilized over here in order to promote their own or to protect the value of their own coins. But there are many reasons why they would do that, but psalto malchut is what we're speaking about when it says nifsal. That's Rav Huna Shita. Rav Yehuda Amar, psalto malchut nami hainu nizdak. When it's taken out of circulation, the government bans the usage of this coin. That's similar to a cracked coin or a broken coin. Elahechi dami nifsal. So then what is the case of nifsal? Shepsalto midina zo v'yotz'ah b'midina acheret. That it's not allowed to be used over here, but it is used in other places. So that means that there is a particular location where the coin is no longer valid, but it's not completely taken out of circulation or completely invalid. So that's the case of nifsal. So here you have psalto malchut, which is that the coin is totally taken out of circulation. It's unable to be used anymore. That's the equivalent of nizdak. That's the equivalent of a cracked coin, because the coin is worthless. That's basically what you're saying. When it's cracked, when it's broken, or if it is nifsal malchut, the gamre, then it's a worthless coin. In a case where the coin has value, it just doesn't have value here, because you can't utilize it over here, That already is a coin that's called Nifsal. That's Rabbi Yehuda's Shita. So now, Amalei Rav Chista Rav Huna. So now Rav Chista challenges Rav Huna's Shita before. Lidi dachta mart Nifsal Psalto Machot. You who say that the meaning of Nifsal in the Mishnah is Psalto Machot. Hare Peirot V'Yirkivu. Yayin V'Yachmitz. If you have a case where you have fruits that went bad, rotted, or you have wine that turned into vinegar, Techi Psalto Machot Domi. That's the equivalent of a regime taking the coin out of circulation. Viktani, Mishalem, Kshata Gzela. And over there, you pay based on the Shata Gzela. Meaning that this is nothing that has necessarily been done to the coin physically. And same too with the wine or the peirot. Nothing was done to them physically in order to have them reach this point. And yet it's still called a Shinui. And if that's the case, then if those are deemed to be a shinui, so too pasalto machut should be deemed to be a shinui. Amalei hatam, like you're suggesting, there is a big difference. Hatam nishtane tamo v'recho, by a fruit or by wine, there is a significant change in the item, a physical change in the item, which is no longer tastes the same, no longer smells the same. So meaning, even if though there was no physical change imposed on the item, but the result is a physical change, which is that the fruits are no longer the same fruits they were before, and the wine is vinegar, it's not wine anymore. Hocha bo nishtane. Here the coin is the exact same coin it was before. The problem is intangible, which is that the problem is that it was taken out of circulation, or the government no longer accepts this coin. But the coin physically looks like it did the day before. It's no different than it was the day before. So Amalei, again here, there's a question. The girsa looks like Rabbo, the Rav Yehuda, that Rabba said this to Rav Yehuda, L'didach, tamar psalto machot, namianu nizdak. You say that when the government takes it out of circulation, that's the equivalent of a cracked or broken coin. Hare truma v'nitmeit. The case of truma that became a tamay, t'chi psalto machot domi, that's the equivalent of it being taken out of circulation. V'tani, and it says, Omer lo, hare shalchal befanecha. And he can say, by the case of truma, take it back, it's yours. We don't consider that to be a shinui. So here the answer is hotam lo minkar hezeka, hacha minkar hezeka. Over there, it's not visible, the damage. Over here, the damage is visible. The way that I would have formulated it is to say that by the case of the truma, there is no visible evidence on the truma to the fact that it is tamei or tahor. Tuma and tahrar are completely intangible items. Items that have no physical manifestation on the Truma itself. The only way you know that Truma is Tumeya or Tehora is that someone tells you, or you see that it came into contact with Truma. But there's no physical evidence on the Truma that it is Tamei. On the other hand, when it comes to a coin that is taken out of circulation, it's obvious that when you see the coin, that that coin is no longer a usable coin. You can see the fact that this coin is a coin that the government said is no longer able to be used or able to be circulated. So even though it's not obvious in the coin itself, but when you see the coin, you know that you have a coin that is no longer usable. So that's a way, the simple way to formulate it. Rashi has a slightly different formulation, which is, Shein tzura zo dome letzura shel kol hayotzim akshav. Looks like this coin doesn't have the same minting as the coins that are out now. But when he stole it, it was the same type of coin that was in circulation. So Rashi claims that it's obvious from the image on the coin that this is not the same coin that is in circulation now versus before when he stole it, it was in circulation. So he talks about it vis-a-vis the other coins that are there. That's how you know. That's what's minkara. I think you don't have to go as far as to say that. You can simply just say that person knows that when he sees this coin, it's an older coin, or this is the old shekel, not the new shekel. And so you know that it's no longer usable or valid currency. So that's the difference between them, according to Rav Yehuda. Now, itmar, hamalvet chavero amatbeya v'nifsala amatbeya. So this is actually an interesting question because it actually has a lot of relevance today, which is that here, if you lent someone on a coinage or a currency that then goes bad during the time of the loan. So you borrow money in a certain type of currency. By the time it comes to the repayment of the loan, the currency is no longer usable or is no longer there. Today in the modern era, that happens, which is that when countries are intentionally devaluing their currencies and you borrowed money in that currency, the money that you paid back in is depreciated or devalued currency. So you're actually giving back significantly less than what you borrowed. That is actually the intent of the, whether it's the central bank or these countries, is exactly to do that. In order to pay off their debts, when they devalue the currency, it becomes cheaper to pay back the debts. So that's a way to monetize the debts, is to print money and then pay back the debts with the printed money. Or in essence, it makes the currency lower and the cost of the borrowing goes down because you're paying back with dollars or shekel that are worth much less than what you borrowed in. So again, here, it's interesting. Rashi claims that the case here, or the situation here, is where he's borrowing money against merchandise. Basically, he sells him merchandise, and then he says, you owe me money. That money that you have to pay has to come back in a certain currency. So based on that, if the currency is nifsal, it went out of circulation in the meantime, what's the story? That's the halacha that we're dealing with here. Rashi, on the other hand, says, if it was a loan, which is that he gave him currency, he gave him a loan in currency, and then he's expected to pay back in currency, Rashi says there that that's not the case. V'davka hilvo pragmatia, Rashi says. Aval hilvo ma'ot et shilvo mishalim lo. He says if he borrowed cash, he can hand him back the same cash. Because he can say to him, listen, I borrowed in shekel, and now I'm going to pay you back in shekel. Oh, the shekel's worthless today because that was the old shekel? If it was in your hand, the old shekel would also be worthless. So I'm just repaying you what you would have had anyway. It's all based on the currency that went between them. And if you repay in the same currency that you borrowed, that's fine. So Rashi says this case here can't be talking about currency to currency borrowing, where you borrow currency and you're giving it back. In that case, you give back exactly what you borrowed and the guy has no claim against you. Here it's a case where he sold him merchandise and then he was paying him the value of the merchandise. Over there, you would look at it differently. It's not that he is taking out a loan. It's really that he owes him the money for that which he purchased or the value of what he purchased. So now there's a question. The currency in which he had promised to pay for it is no longer valuable. So now is he really returning the value that he purchased from him or the merchandise that he gave him? And that's the question. That's the way Rashi formulates it and frames it. And you can see that in Rashi, he says here it's pragmatia. And then the next Amud, he says that it's definitely not a loan. Tosfot is unmoved by Rashi's claim. And he says it doesn't make any sense. Tosfot says that the case here is irrespective of whether it's a loan or whether it's merchandise. The din is exactly the same. And Tosfot's main idea or proof is that when someone lends them money, the expectation is that you're going to give them back their same currency, assuming that the currency has value. I mean, you can't give them back something that is worthless and say you are repaid. Now, had it been that, yes, it was devalued in the meantime, maybe that would be fine, because it's still a going currency. It's still a currency that has value. It may be significantly diminished, but it has value. So Tosafot's qualification is that it has to be that the coin is still a going currency. As long as it's a going currency, you can pay back in it. If it's totally taken out of circulation, it's no longer a valid form of payment. You're not giving him anything. How can you claim that you're giving him back the repayment of the loan? Therefore, Tosafot says the din is exactly the same for a loan or for merchandise. But the key element here is it has to be currency that is going currency. As long as it's going currency, we're fine. If it's out of circulation, then whether it's a loan or whether it's for merchandise, you cannot use that to repay. Rashi does not make that distinction. That's what bothers Tosafot, which is it has to be that you're paying him back money. You can't be paying him back something that is nothing. So at least it has to be a going currency. And for that reason, he doesn't differentiate like Rashi differentiates over here. So therefore, itmar malvet chaviro matzbea benifsela, hamatzbea, the currency was taken out of circulation. Rav amar noten lo matzbea yotzei boto shah. Rav says you got to pay him with going currency. You cannot utilize the currency that has been taken out of circulation. Shmuel amar yechol amar lo lech hotzio b'meishan. Go and expend it in Meishan. Meishan is a place in Bavel. We bumped into it in Gittin because it's a place where all the psulim lived. It's a problematic place. It's a place where there were Jews, but there was a heavy non-Jewish population there as well. And many mamzerim and psulei akal lived in Meishan. But it's an area that was even on the outskirts, we'll call it, of the Jewish community in Bavel. So now, what Shmuel says is, as long as, and this is what it seems to be, this is what drives Tosfot in that direction, is as long as this currency still has value somewhere, then it's currency, and you can repay with it. And you can say to the person who lent you the money, or here it's, according to those who lent you the money, according to Rashi, you're paying the merchandise too. Okay, you can't utilize it here, but if you go to Meishan, they accept the coinage over there. What that means is not clear in the Gemara, whether Meshan was a unique city where they were a commercial city where they took lots of different currencies and therefore you were able to use it, or they weren't so makpid on the coinage, or just Meshan means some faraway place. It's not necessarily particular to Meshan. Meshan's just an example of somewhere far away, but they'll take the coin over there, you go utilize it over there. So what Shmuel says is, as long as the coin can be utilized somewhere, you can say to him, that's your problem where you use it, but I'm giving you coinage that still has relevance somewhere. So Rav Nachman, qualifies that and says, "Mistavra milton dishmol to eat lay orcha the mezel the meshan." That's only true where the guy has a way or a reason to be in meshan. Avalet lay orcha alone. But if he has no reason or no way to get to meshan, then it doesn't make sense. We're not going to say to him, "Go and expend money to get your money's worth," because then you basically are saying that you have to now pay money to get the value out of your money. That we don't say. If the guy is otherwise going to end up in Meshan, or he has merchandise or business over there, so then maybe you can say that to him. You can't just, out of the blue, tell him, listen, you gotta get on a plane, get over there, and you can use the currency over there. That's not a fair assumption. That's what Rav Nachman's qualification of what Shmuel says over here. Now, Eitve Rova the Rav Nachman. So now Rova challenges Rav Nachman. Here you have three generations of Talmidim. Rav Nachman is a Talmid of Shmuel, and Rova is a Talmid of Rav Nachman. So Rav Nachman qualified Shmuel's statement, and now his student Rova is challenging that. Ein mechalalin ala ma'ot she'en an yotzot. When it comes to Meiser Sheni, you're not allowed to redeem the Meiser Sheni on currencies that are not utilized. Ketzad, what's that mean? Hayulo ma'ot kuzbiot Yerushalmiot osho malachim rishonim. Over here, it's not clear how to read this. It could either be hayulo ma'ot kuzbiot, comma, Yerushalmiot, Osho Malchim Rishonim, so you have three different coins over here. Or it could be that it is Hayula Ma'ot Kuzbiot Yerushalmiot, which is a noun phrase. Osho Malchim Rishonim, so only two coins over here. Rashi brings both interpretations. Kuzbiot is Kuziva. Most people translate that to be Bar Kuziva or Bar Kochva. These were the coins of Bar Kochva. If you read it as a noun phrase, then that would be Kuzbiot Yerushalmiot. The coins of Bar Kochva that had Yerushalayim on them. The Bar Kochva coins had pictures of a Beit HaMikdash on them. Those are the coins that they found, the Bar Kochva coins, or a menorah on them. The archaeologists have found these coins of Bar Kochva. So that's what it could be referring to. Milachim Rishonim seem to be coins that were used by the earlier kings, meaning that when the Jewish autonomy still existed in Eretz Yisrael, those are the coins of those kings before the Romans took over and they became the authorities here, and the Roman coinage or currency became the coinage of the time. So Melachim Rishonim and Bar Kuzbia coins are basically coins of a revolt or a revolution that was taking place, or coins of the earlier kings who are now no longer relevant because the Romans don't want those kings. In both cases, you can understand why the Romans don't allow these coins to be used, is because they are politically untenable to have these coins be in usage, and therefore they are posel, the currency. That's the one way. The other way Rashi says is Ma'ot Kuzbiot would be Bar Kochva coins, and Yerushalmiot are those of the Yerushalmi coins, meaning that coins of Yerushalayim, which again, it's not clear what that means, which is that these are coins of Yerushalayim are printed with Yerushalayim that have something politically untenable, again, on them, whether it's a picture of the Mikdash or the Menorah, which the Romans won't accept as coinage. Rashi also brings the other possibility that Kuzbiot is from Kziv. There's a coinage from the city or the area of Kziv, which is not Bar Kochva, but rather Kziv. So those are the different possibilities as to what we're talking about here. But obviously we're talking about coinage that is no longer accepted as going currency because of the problems. So now you cannot use those coins to redeem your Meiser Sheni, Ein Mechalalim. How shall achronim dumya derishonim? But if they are coins of something that is more current, but they are similar to the coins of the earlier time, michalalim, you could use them. So as Rashi explains over here, that achronim means that these are currencies that are modern. I'm talking about these are currencies that are now currently being utilized, but for whatever reason, the local government doesn't allow them to be used. So they can be used in other places. They just can't be used over here. For whatever reason, because those are coins of the Melachim Achronim, the latest king. That might be that there was a new Caesar. Might be that there was some sort of Persian invasion. Whatever it is that causes the coins not to be utilized anymore, But the coins have value somewhere. They have coins in other parts of the empire or places which were not conquered. These coins have value. Just they're not valuable here because of whatever the circumstances is that the government won't allow them to be utilized. So what Rabbi Yehuda says, the diuk that he makes out of this Tosefta in Maaser Sheni is that as long as the coins can be used somewhere, it seems that you can be mechalel on them because it was only coins that were taken out of circulation, the gamre, which is like the earlier kings, the Bar Kokhba coins, those you can't redeem with. But coins of the current currency that are not utilized here, but somewhere else are used, you could redeem with them. And that would be against Rav Nachman. Rav Nachman said that only if you can utilize the coins and he has way to get there, here it seems to be it doesn't matter. Whatever, as long as the coin has value somewhere else, you can utilize it, and it does not explain it based on the qualification that Rav Nachman gave. So now, Amalei Rav Nachman, Hakamai Skinan, She'ein Malchiot Makbitot Zo'al Zo. Over here, we're speaking about a case where the kingdoms are not so makbid, they're not so careful about this disqualification of the currency. Elaki Amar Shmuel, Kish Malchiot Makbitot Zo'al Zo. But Shmuel's statement is made in a case where the governments do not allow the currency, meaning that it's illegal to use the currency. So there's a big difference between when you're using illegal tender, there you can't use it at all, and there only if the person has access to the location where it's valuable will you consider it to be currency. On the other hand, in a place where the currency is not illegal, they just won't utilize it here, they won't accept it over here, so if you go to the other place, then you can utilize it, that's fine, because then it's not a legal tender. The Gemara says, wait a minute, Heichi Matzi Mamatiluhu. If it's a case where the Machpiot or Machpidot Zozu, they are Machpidot to the place where it's an illegal tender, then how does he ever utilize them? How could you even suggest at that point that that's considered to be good currency? So he says, that you can utilize them in extenuating circumstances. The Bach takes this out of the Girsa, but it's the next explanation which is important. Lelo Bachashai, Bimishkachei Kapte. So this is an interesting thing. The word Bachash in the Gemara means to mix. It's actually utilized in the Melachot Bishul in Shabbat. Livchosh or Bachash means to mix. So the connection between the words, and I'll explain to you what it means, the word Bachash also means to examine or to check out. And so what mixing means is to get to the bottom of something. When you stir the pot, you're trying to get to the bottom of the pot. You're trying to circulate that which is at the bottom to the top. Bachash over here in this context means to examine. So the situation here is that they don't check you at the border. They don't go and do checks to see if you're carrying this currency and take away or confiscate any currency that's there. But if you utilize it in public, if you take it out in public, they're going to be makpid on it. So here, this is the case. They made it into illegal tender. It's illegal tender that if you show it or you utilize it over here, they're not going to accept it and they're going to be makpid. You might even get punished for it. On the other hand, if you're walking around with a tender in your pocket and you take it out of the country, they're not going to stop you from doing that. They won't stop you. They're not makpid on that. So it's not like here when you, every time you get on the plane, they make sure that you're not taking any currency out of the country, right? There were cases like that in South Africa at some points where you weren't allowed to take the rand out of South Africa. So that where they forced the currency to remain in the country and they would check you before you left that you're not taking out that currency. Today, that's true in, America as well. They check a certain amount. You only have to take a certain amount of currency out of the country. There, they don't want money laundering going on. But you have limits on the currency and they'll check for that currency. That's a case where they're checking and examining and they won't let you leave with that currency. But certain places, they don't want you leaving with the currency. But if you leave with the currency and you don't show or if you don't make it obvious, they're not going to bother you and then you can utilize the currency outside. So that's the difference over here. The case is a case. There's certain times where Makpido Zuazu means so much so that you can't even move the currency around because it's so illegal or they want it out of circulation so badly. You could probably understand that in the Roman times with Bar Kokhba coins, that if they found Bar Kokhba coins, they would be significantly upset about it and they might even examine people to make sure to take them out of circulation to quash the very spirit of the rebellion and to take them out of circulation. Other coins, we've been talking about earlier Jewish kings, earlier times, maybe over there, they wouldn't examine for it, but if you took out a coin like that, they'd be upset. They'd be makpid on it, but they're not going to examine or try to get rid of that type of coin. So that's the case here, or the difference between Rav Nachman, what Rav Nachman says, I'm qualifying in Shmuel's case. That's a case where the Medinot are makpidot zu al zu, not so much so that they're examining for it, but Enough so that they won't let you use it as a going currency here. So you have to take the tender over to that other location in order to use it. Over there, I say that only if he has the ability to get there or is otherwise going there, do I say that that's good currency. On the other hand, the case here by the Tosefta that talks about Maisu Sheni, that's a case where they're not so makpid. The currency is not supposed to be used over here. But the governments aren't so careful about this. They don't enforce this ruining of the currency. And over there, you could utilize it to redeem Maisu Sheni because that type of money is really a going currency even here. Because they're not makpid if you use it here. They prefer, they told you not to utilize it. But if you do utilize it, or people accept it, they're not going to stop you from utilizing it. Now the Gemara says, Tashma, Ein mechalalin amaot shel kan, vehein bebavel. Now, over here, when you're talking about kan, we're talking about Mishnaic works. Mishnaic works are written in Eretz Yisrael. So kan means Eretz Yisrael. So you have coinage of Eretz Yisrael, and now you've taken those coins to Bavel, and now you want to redeem Maaser Sheni in Bavel on those coins. Or, Shebavel v'hein kan. Or you have Babylonian coins, and now you're in Eretz Yisrael and want to redeem Maaser Sheni in Eretz Yisrael. So now, in those two scenarios where it is the coinage of Eretz Yisrael in Bavel, or the coinage of Bavel in Eretz Yisrael, there you cannot redeem the Maaser Sheni with that coin, because that coin is not a currency over here where you're trying to redeem the Maaser Sheni. Shebavel v'hein bebavel. On the other hand, if you have Babylonian coins and you're in Bavel, Michalalin. If it is Hein Shel Bavel and you're in Bavel, if it's Babylonian coinage and you're in Babylon, then you're allowed to utilize that currency to redeem the Maaser Sheni. Tani Miat, Ein Michalalin Amaot Shel Kan VeHein Shel Bavel. You're not allowed to use Yerushalmi or Eretz Yisrael coins to redeem Maaser Sheni in Bavel. Afal Gav Tosofel Lemesei Katam. Even though in the end he has to bring that coinage or currency up to Eretz Yisrael. What do you do with monies in Maaser Sheni? You bring them up to Yerushalayim. So the end game here is that he's going to redeem this Maaser Sheni in Bavel with Eretz Yisrael coins, and then he's going to go to Eretz Yisrael. That's where he has to bring the Maaser Sheni to. So if that's the case, that is exactly your scenario, Rav Nachman. This is a problem for Rav Nachman's explanation. Because Rav Nachman says, if you're going to end up there in the end, it is good currency. And over here, the Braita says if you use Eretz Yisrael coins in Bavel, that is not the case. It says, Hachem Mayeskinan, Kishemalchiot, Makpidot, Zoal Zol. Again, a case where these areas, the coinage cannot be utilized in each other's territory. It says, Yehachi, Shal Bavel, Behem Bebavel. If that's the case, then why are you allowed to utilize Babylonian coins in Babylon? Because if you go to Bavel and you use the Babylonian coins, which is the local currency, there the Braita says it's okay. But if you're telling me that the Malchiot or Makpidot Zozo, that means that when you get to Eretz Yisrael, those Babylonian coins will not be able to be utilized. So then you're redeeming Maaser Sheni onto money that won't be able to utilize when you get to Eretz Yisrael. Then what's the point of putting it onto coinage that can't be used when you get to Eretz Yisrael? The Mai Chazul, what is it going to be useful for when you get to Eretz Yisrael? It says, Chazul de Zavin Bo Beima O Meisik de Yerushalayim. Because what you can do is you can buy an animal locally and then take it up to Yerushalayim. So basically you can consolidate the value. The whole point of putting the Maaser Sheni onto coinage, we read this in last week's Parsha, is because Vitzarta Kesef Yadecha, you'll then be able to transport it. You'll put it in your hand and you'll transport it up to Yerushalayim. Because transporting the actual goods up to Yerushalayim is too difficult. So over here what we do is we allow you to consolidate the value onto coinage and bring it up to Yerushalayim. So what the Gemara says is, okay, if the coinage is the local coinage or currency, but cannot be utilized up in Eretz Yisrael, you're still allowed to use it locally because it's a going currency locally, and the qualifications for a coinage or currency that can be utilized to redeem Maaser Sheni is, number one, it is a going currency here, and number two is that it has a tzurah, it has some sort of minted form on it. So that we can do here. What about the fact that you can't use it up in Eretz Yisrael? What you'll do is you'll use that money to buy an animal. An animal is also consolidation of value. It's much easier to bring an animal up to Yerushalayim than it is to bring the actual fruits or vegetables up to Yerushalayim. Because, again, you've consolidated it into a single entity. It's an animal that can walk itself and move itself up to Yerushalayim. So therefore, you could, in a way, use it locally, consolidate the value, and still take it up to Yerushalayim. And that's what it means over here. Now, the Balei HaTosafot and many of the Rishonim, as you can see on the side there, that they note that many of the Rishonim are bothered by the fact that it seems from here, the way that we're reading the Gemara, that the Gemara is only a question on Rav Nachman. And what the Balei HaTosafot point out is that this question that we're asking over here is a question on Shmuel, and it's a question on Rav as well. It seems to be a question on everybody here, not just on the sheet of Rav Nachman. The Gemara solely focuses on Rav Nachman, it seems, and answers for Rav Nachman, even though if you look at it more carefully, it is also a question on Shmuel. Shmuel says that you have to have a currency that is Yecholot Tziyov Meishan, as long as you can utilize it in Meishan. Over here, the Braita doesn't talk about whether you transport or don't transport it. It says it has to be a currency that can be utilized somewhere else. That's not true in the Braita over here. The Braita over here allows you, in Bavel, to use Babylonian currency, even though that Babylonian currency can't be utilized somewhere else. Or, in the Braita over here, it says that you can't use Eretz Yisrael coinage in Bavel, or Bavel coinage in Eretz Yisrael, even though they could be used in the other place. So according to Shmuel, this Braita is a significant problem for him. So what the Balei HaTosafot suggests over here is something that we just mentioned now, that maybe the din of Maaser Sheni is unique. That Maaser Sheni needs more than simply a currency that can be utilized somewhere else. It has to be Kesef in the current location. And that is a unique principle or demand that we have by Maaser Sheni that doesn't necessarily color the halacha of currency or the value of currency. So therefore, Shmuel's din can be true, even though over here we might demand a higher standard, which is it has to be able to be utilized in the local market, that Shmuel will agree to because that is unique to the din of Maaser Sheni. The other way that Tosfot differentiates over here is Venir Lari, that maybe the way to distinguish over here, or the way that Shmuel can deal with it, is that the nature of the coins, which is that when you talk about a coin that's Nifsal, that was taken out of circulation in this location, it was once utilized over here. It was once good currency over here. Now the government says it's no longer good currency, but it's still good currency in the other location. Over there, Shmuel says that's still good currency. It was once good currency here. It is still utilized in the other location. That is good currency. In our situation in the Braita, we're talking about coins of Eretz Yisrael that are not utilized in Bavel, and coins of Bavel that are not utilized in Eretz Yisrael. But these coins were never utilized in those locations. It was never that the coins of Bavel were once accepted in Eretz Yisrael, now they're no longer accepted. They were never accepted in Eretz Yisrael. And same vice versa, the coins of Eretz Yisrael were never accepted in Bavel. In that situation, that might, even Shmuel might agree there, that that's not a going currency. Because they were never valid in the local market. And so that's another way to make a distinction here between the case in the Braita, where we're talking about currency that was never valid in the local market, versus the case of Shmuel, where it was once valid in the local market, but now has been taken out of circulation or not allowed to be used in this market. So again, the Rishonim try to come up with ways to distinguish between the din of Shmuel and the din of the Braita, in order that it's not a question on Shmuel, and only a problem for Rav Nachman's qualification of Shmuel. Now, the fact that you can buy a behema over here with the monies that you have in Bavel, Tosfot already knows that might be a machloket in the Tanaim, as to whether you can redeem the Ma'ot Maaser Sheni onto an animal, and then bring up the animal to Yerushalayim, and then sell it again, or monetize it in Yerushalayim, or utilize it in Yerushalayim. Because, Taima de'en luchim be'ema be'ma'ot Maaser Sheni, what's the reason that we don't allow you to buy an animal with Ma'ot Maaser Sheni? Rashi claims, not here, but in Kedushin, Rashi says the reason is, Mishum de kachasha. That is, because it weakens. Meaning that if you buy an animal with it, then transport it up to Yerushalayim, the animal is going to lose weight and lose value on the way up to Yerushalayim because it's going to go through the travails of the journey going from where it is up to Yerushalayim and it'll be worth less. So you're not actually storing value because the value will diminish in the transport between here and Yerushalayim. So that's why Rashi says the reason why you cannot do this. Tosfot says that's not the right reason. Elokim mefaresh b'sukkah. The real reason is the Gemara brings in sukkah. Tosfot says the main problem is that we're afraid that you're going to bring up flocks and flocks of them. If a person then buys an animal with Maaser Sheni, we're afraid then he's going to keep those animals around and then make up flocks and flocks. He'll keep them and he'll basically manage a flock of Maaser Sheni and he'll quote-unquote increase the value of Maaser Sheni by keeping the animal of Maaser Sheni, having it reproduce, and then making more and more animals of Maaser Sheni. We don't want you doing that. We want the items to end up in Yerushalayim and eat in Yerushalayim. So in order to prevent that, the Chachamim say don't buy animals with the monies of Maaser Sheni. Tosfot points out that the Gemara is clear that if you're buying females, no chance you can buy a live animal that's a female, because that's clearly a problem of growing flocks and flocks of them. This is machloket about Zicharim. So anyway, Tosfot notes that there are other shitot that don't allow you to purchase a behema with ma'ot ma'isr sheni. The reason being, according to Rashi, because of kachasha, because of the travails of the journey and the loss of value. According to Tosafot, because we don't want you bringing up flocks and flocks of ma'isr sheni. But again, here we're dealing with an opinion in our Gemara that says you can use it, the ma'ot ma'isr sheni, to buy a behema. Or Tosafot suggests that maybe this is b'shat ha'dchak, that normally we don't allow you to redeem it on an animal, but in these extenuating circumstances, we allow you to transport the value through an animal, even though that's normally not allowed. Right? Says, "Va'atanya, don't we have a brayta? Itkinu she'ei ha'ma'ot yotzot b'Yerushalayim mipnei kach." There was an institution that all currencies would be accepted in Yerushalayim. I mean, the Chachamim put into effect that Yerushalayim was, quote-unquote, an international city, and since people were bringing monies of Ma'aser Sheni and Korbanot from all lands and countries, they made an institution that basically all currencies are valid inside of Yerushalayim, and that people have to accept any currency that's brought up into Yerushalayim. If that's the case, then how do we explain the previous brayta that says that you can't bring up the Babylonian coins into Eretz Yisrael because they're makpid on that? What do you mean they're makpid? They're makpid maybe in the country, but in Yerushalayim they accepted all coins. So then the coins would have been accepted there. So what's the problem? When it says, I'm Rav Zeira Lokasha, kan bizman shiyad yisrael tkifal umot olam, kan bizman shiyad umot olam tkifal atzman. Difference is, who is in charge? If it's an autonomous Jewish state, then they can dictate what the rules are, and Chazal put into effect that the rules are that Yerushalayim will accept currencies from every country. On the other hand, when the yad umot tkifal atzman, here it's lashon tzagi nahor, it's a way to express it without saying it, which is that the other nations have jurisdiction over this area, or they are the ruling parties over a Klal Yisrael. In that case, they're the ones who dictate what currencies are good and what currencies are not good. And now they're saying that the Babylonian currency is not accepted over here. We can't change that. We can't overrule that because it's not our prerogative to make that decision. And so because of that, they're no longer accepted in Yerushalayim, even though there was an earlier takana to accept all currencies in Yerushalayim. Now the Gemara asks an interesting question. Tan Rabbanan, Ezo Matbeya Shel Yerushalayim. What is the coinage of Yerushalayim? Before we said they were coins Yerushalmiot. These Yerushalayim coins, what are they? Davidu Shlomo Mitzad Echad, Yerushalayim Yer HaKodesh Mitzad Acher. It's a coin that on one side has a picture of, I'm saying this loosely, has a picture of David and Shlomo, and the other side has a picture of the Beit HaMikdash. Rashi claims over here that that's not the case. It's a case that on one side it is written David Ushlomo, and the other side it is written Yerushalayim Ir HaKodesh. There are no pictures on the coin, but rather it's writing or inscriptions on both sides. One side says David Ushlomo, the other side of the coin says Yerushalayim Ir HaKodesh. That's the way Rashi describes it. Ve'ezu matbeya shel Avram Avinu. What is the coin of Avram Avinu? Zakeinu skena mitzad echad. Has an older couple on one side. Ubachur betula mitzad acher. And a younger couple on the other side. Rashi over here does not say katuv, that it's written on the coin. Rashi seemingly, in contrast to what he said before, says that there are images here. There's an image of a older couple on one side and an image of a younger couple on the other side. Rashi claims the older couple is Avram and Sarah, and the younger couple is Yitzchak v'Rivka. That's the way Rashi claims it. I think you could have argued that they're both Avram and Sarah. And that's the whole idea of having the coin as an elderly couple on one side and a younger couple on the other side, is that's Avram Avinu and Sarah, who had children very late in life. They regained their youth later in life. And that would be the idea of the coin, that you have an older couple on the one side and a younger couple on the other side. Tosafot over here says that he thinks that's wrong, that there were no images on the coins, because based on the Gemara and Avodah Zarah, it's asur to create images on metal, because of problems of a Avodah Zarah, or the Torah demands that we do not make images or graven images. So he says that it wouldn't be possible that the coins had pictures of Avram and Sarah on one side and Yitzchak on the other side, but rather he explains it similar to what Rashi said in the previous case, that on one side it's written Zakein v'Zakeina, and on the other side it's written Bachur v'Bechura. So it's not images, but rather the statements. It's Zakein v'Zakeina on one side, and Bachur and Bachura on the other side, Dasur l'asot Tzurat Adam. Because you're not allowed to make Tzurat Adam. If you look in the Gemara in Avodah Zarah and Daf Nun Bet and the Tosfot over there, he again deals with it over there, and maybe there are ways to come up with permissions when it's okay to put an image of something on a coin where it's not in violation of the issues of Avodah Zarah, making graven images. And there, Rishonim deal with that question. And again, the coins that come up in archaeology in general have pictures on them. Some of them have writing as well, but most of them do have images on them. Tosfot's main issue here is an image of a human being, which is the problem. Not necessarily when we're talking about the previous case with Yushalayim. But with David and Shlomo, it's a problem, because then again, those are images of people. So Tosfot says that he liked what Rashi says about David and Shlomo and wants to continue that into the next case as well of the coin. Whereas Rashi seems to differentiate between David and Shlomo versus Avram and Sarah, and what he calls Yitzchak and Rivka, the Zaken and Zakena, and the Bachur and Bachura. All right, now the Gemara says, "Vay minei Rova mirav Chista." Rova queried Rav Chista and says, "Amavet chaviro amatbeya veosifu alav mahu." Person lent the person money. This is a variation of the case before, and then the government increased the value of the currency by expanding the size of the coin. Remember that the coins there are made out of the underlying metal. If you have more metal, the coin is worth more. So even though the coin says the same name as it did before, it now has a larger metal content to it, and therefore it's worth more. So originally the weight of that coin was an ounce, a gram, and now they've increased the weight of the coins going forward. So now what does he have to return? What does he pay back with? Amar lo, yotein lo matbeya yotzei boto shah. Like Rav, this is basically in the sheet of Rav, you still use the same coin that is now in usage. Meaning that, just like before, Rav says you have to give going currency at the time. Similarly, when you repay the loan, you have to repay with these larger coins. Even if they expanded the size of the coin to the size of a sieve, do you have to do it? He said yes. Even if it's the size of a tartia, Rashi says, Sela gadol b'mida machzek and rova akav. It's a massive coin or something huge. Would that also be the case? He says yes. So he says it doesn't matter how much they increase the size of the coin. The person now has to pay back a coin in the new size. He says back to him, Vaika zilinen peire. Isn't that because the cost of items has now gone down? Meaning that the relationship between the coin and the fruit has now changed. As Rashi notes over here, if you're giving him back larger coins, for instance, before, say this gram of silver bought you a kilo worth of fruits, now this larger coin still does not buy you a kilo worth of fruits, because then if that was the case, you're right, there wouldn't be any change. But we know is now that this larger coin, the same percentage increase in the grams of the silver, you also get that increase in the kilo. So if they increase the size of the coin by 10%, that means now that you have 1.1 grams of silver, you'd also get now 1.1 kilo of fruits. That means that this guy originally, especially according to Rashi, says the scenario here is when you're talking about merchandise, so he again bought a kilo worth of fruit from him originally and said, I'm going to give you back a silver coin that's a gram. We come back later, and now that coin is now been increased in size to 1.1 grams. The new version of the coin, or the coin now, is expanded. They've created a coin that's now 1.1 grams. So now, what's going to happen is he's going to hand him back these 1.1 gram coins. The person who receives the coins now can go out and buy 1.1 kilo of fruit or vegetables. That means that, in essence, he lent them a kilo, and he's getting back 1.1 kilo. He's actually charged him interest, or he's benefiting from the loan that he gave to this individual. So that's what his point is. Wait, if you're increasing the size of the coins, and those coins are now buying you more than you bought before, then that isn't a fair exchange. So, Amar Rav Ashi, Chazinan, Imach Mativa Zil, Menachinan Le, Imach Matara Zil, Lo Menachinan Le. It depends on why there's been a change in the price relationship between the coin and the fruits. Again, if we're talking about the coinage being a shekel, call it here, that shekel before weighed a gram, it now weighs 1.1 grams. What that shekel buys changes. There are two reasons why that could change. It could change now because the coin size is bigger. Since the coin size is worth more, you'll collect more fruits. That you're right about, and that would be the equivalent of interest or imputed interest because you're getting a larger coin back for what you lent out before. That you're right, we would say payback, basically a reduced number of coins in order to make it equal to the value they took out before. On the other hand, the reason that fruits could be cheaper now has nothing to do with the larger size coins, but has to do with the vagaries of the market. As Rashi says over here, all of a sudden it rained, and the supply on the market increased significantly. and the fruit prices went down. Nothing to do with the larger coins, but something to do with the market price of the fruits. So Rashi says we have to test and figure out what was the causing the diminishment in the cost of fruit. Is it the largest coin size? Or is it the marketplace now that says that fruits are cheaper? If it's because the fruits are cheaper, you have to pay the bigger coin, because you're not giving him more fruits now. You're just simply giving him the coin, and the coin buys more fruits because the market price of the fruits has changed. On the other hand, if it's because of the larger size coin that you're getting more fruit, then we have to adjust based on that. Where it says, "Va'akas shavach linya naska," even if you say that the price has changed because of the marketplace change in fruits, and you still have to pay the larger coin, when he gets the larger coin, he still has raw metal that is larger than what he had borrowed. He again sold the fruits and offered to give him a shekel at the time, which was a gram of silver. Now the coin is 1.1 grams of silver. That means in the end, the person who lent him the money ends up with more silver than he had lent to him. And why is that the case? Why is he allowed to do that? Why do we say that you can give back more silver? So again, in their day where the coins were made up of the true underlying metal, when you repay him the larger coin, you're giving him a larger amount of silver. And that means that no matter what happened to the market price of the fruits, when you give him the larger coin, you're just giving him more silver back. So Ella, ki hadra papa rav huna brei rav Yeshua, avdei uvdo. We have a case where this exact situation came up. The Zuzei de Agadamis Tayo. Agadamis Tayo was this Arab merchant. Ad yud betamia, up to 8 to 10 is the relationship. Over here, it's not clear what that means. It's Machloket Rashi and Rabbeinu Hananel, exactly what that means. Rashi over here says that they had done this, they had borrowed money, and in the meantime, the coins had changed. The size of the coins had changed. So what they did was they went to this socher, they went to this merchant, who was an expert in coinage or currency, or was a money exchanger. Or as Rashi explains over here, he was some sort of coin collector that had the old coins, and therefore they were able to compare the old coins to the new coins. And they basically asked him, what is the equivalent between the old coinage and the new coinage? And that's what it says here. So Rashi says that now, the new coins and their increased size, 8 of those new coins is equivalent to the value of 10 of the previous coins. V'natan lo shmona. And therefore, they gave him 8. So what Rashi says is that the new coinage, which is bigger, has 8 of those coins is equal to 10 of the old coins. Increase the size by 25%. So if I take 8 coins times 1.25, that gives me the equivalent of 10. Or that the old coins are 20% smaller than the new coins. And so therefore, I give 8 of the new coins. That's the way Rashi explains it. Tosfos quotes from the Beinu Hananel. That says it the other way around. That the Rabbeinu Hananel says, so he says, Ad yud betamya, when it's 8 to 10, you would pay 10 of the new coins based on the old coins. Meaning, so up to that 25% threshold, including the 25% threshold, you still pay in the number of old coins. So in a case of relationship where 10 of the old coins equals 8 of the new coins, you would pay 10 of the new coins because that differential is not big enough. That 25% is not. Once you went beyond that, it's not. So all he's saying is whether it's ad bad bichlau, meaning depending if you're coming from a higher to lower or lower to higher, will determine whether the 8 to 10 relationship belongs to those that you no longer pay the same number of new coins as old coins, or whether that's still included in those that you do pay. So according to Rashi, that's already over the threshold. And if it's an 8 to 10 relationship, a 25% relationship, you pay the 8 new coins and not the 10 coins. According to Rabbeinu Hananel, if you have 8 new coins is equal to 10 old coins, you'll still pay 10 new coins in that scenario. Once you go beyond that, then you start paying in the new coinage and forget about the number relationship between them. The Gemara is saying that 25% is the threshold. The only difference between Rashi and the Rabbeinu Hananel is what happens if it's exactly 25%. According to Rashi, if it's exactly 25%, it's already over the threshold and you pay with the new coinage and that's it. According to Rabbeinu Hananel, 25% is still within the threshold. It's only beyond 25% that it is problematic. But that is the threshold. Okay, we're going to stop over here, 4 lines down on the top of Tzadik Chet Amud Aleph.